Hello and welcome to the January 2024 edition of Roundabout, the Dawlish and Tynmouth area talking newspaper's monthly magazine. I'm Camilla Taylor. Here is what we have in store for you in this month's programme. Sue Smallwood will be reading her story entitled Murder at the Old Folks' Home. David Picton will be reading his poem entitled Walking on Water. Stephen Taylor and Mary MacDonald will be discussing the book they have read recently. Valerie Forrester will be reading an article about the lack of knowledge of current affairs amongst many young people. Fran Frank will be sharing some facts and figures related to a particular location in Devon. John Townsend will be sharing the history behind a very famous nursery rhyme. Norma Orty will be reading a selection of limericks that she has written. I will be sharing a simple vegetarian recipe with you. There will be some information from the charity Blind Veterans UK, and we will conclude the programme with a piece of music. Well, another year has gone by and we are in 2024. Almost a quarter of the 21st century has gone by. I thought I'd share the following with you. Find out for yourself as to how many you can remember. Famous events that took place in January over the years. 1st of January 1999, the Euro officially debuts. The 1st of January 1999 saw the Euro currency come into existence as 11 nations adopted the single currency. 1st of January 2022, hottest New Year's Day on record. 2022 was the warmest ever year in the UK, and it was kicked off with the hottest New Year's Day with 16.3 degrees Celsius recorded at St. James Park, London. 4th January 1948, Burma gains independence from the UK. British rule in the Southeast Asian country, now called Myanmar, began in 1824 and lasted until 1948, at which point Burma chose to become fully independent. 6th January 1066, Harold II is crowned King of England. He was the last crowned Anglo-Saxon English king. He reigned for a matter of months before his death at the Battle of Hastings in 1066, after which the Normans ruled England for the next 300 years. 7th January 1943, famed scientist and inventor Nikola Tesla dies. A pioneer of the electrical revolution, the Serbian-American invented the first alternating current motor and developed AC generation and transmission technology. 7th January 1979, Pol Pot overthrown. Pol Pot, the political leader of the brutal Khmer Rouge government in Cambodia, was finally overthrown by Vietnamese troops after they seized the Cambodian capital of Phnom Penh. Around 2 million people died at the hands of Pot's radical communist government. 9th January 2007. Steve Jobs debuts iPhone. Apple CEO Steve Jobs unveiled the iPhone at the Macworld convention in San Francisco. The revolutionary piece of technology put the internet in everyone's pocket, forever changing the world in the process. 15th January 1559, Elizabeth I, crowned Queen of England. Heralded as one of England's greatest monarchs, Elizabeth I, who oversaw the defeat of the Spanish Armada, was crowned on the 15th of January 1559. 17th January 1773, Captain James Cook becomes the first European to venture south of the Antarctic Circle. 20th January 2009, Barack Obama became the first African-American president in the history of the United States after he was sworn in as the country's 44th president. 22nd January 1901, Queen Victoria dies. She reigned for nearly 64 years, making her Britain's second longest reigning monarch. Queen Victoria's reign was synonymous with Britain's industrial development, economic progression, and imperial expansion. When she died, the British Empire was almost at its peak, covering a quarter of the world and nearly half a billion people. 24th January 1965, Winston Churchill passes away. Arguably the greatest political leader in British history, Winston Churchill guided Britain and the Allies through World War II. He died at the age of 90 after suffering a stroke. 25th January 1947, Al Capone dies. Known as one of the most infamous gangsters in history, Al Capone passed away at the age of 48. 27th January 1944, the Siege of Leningrad ends. Lasting 872 days, the Siege of Leningrad was one of the longest and most destructive sieges in history. The Axis powers began their blockade of the Soviet city in September 1941, and by the time it ended in 1944, 1 million civilians had been killed. 27th January 1945, liberation of Auschwitz. Located in southern Poland, Auschwitz was Nazi Germany's largest and most lethal concentration camp. Around 1.5 million people, mostly Jews, died at Auschwitz during the Holocaust. The camp was finally liberated by Soviet troops on 27th January 1945. 28th January 1986, Space Shuttle Challenger explodes. Just 73 seconds after liftoff from Cape Canaveral in Florida, the US Space Shuttle Challenger broke up live on television. All seven astronauts on board were killed. The cause of the crash was due to an O-ring seal failure in one of the solid fuel rockets. 30th January 1933, Hitler becomes Chancellor of Germany. Germany took one step closer to becoming a dictatorship when Hitler was formally appointed as the country's new Chancellor. With the Nazi Party's grip on Germany tightening, the world was headed on a new path toward war. 30th January 1948, Gandhi assassinated. Mahatma Gandhi, the leader of India's non-violent independence movement against colonial British rule, was shot and killed by a Hindu extremist in New Delhi. 30th January 1965, Sir Winston Churchill's state funeral takes place at St. Paul's Cathedral. It was the first state funeral of a politician in the century and the biggest national event since the coronation of Queen Elizabeth II in 1953. 30th January 2020, first cases of COVID-19 in the UK. The first two cases of COVID-19 in the UK were confirmed after Chinese nationals staying in York were diagnosed with coronavirus. 31st January 1606, Guy Fawkes jumps to his death. Famous for his role in the gunpowder plot to blow up the Houses of Parliament, Guy Fawkes was found guilty of treason in a show trial in 1606. On 31st January, he managed to avoid being hung, drawn, and quartered by leaping to his death as he awaited the gallows. 31st January 2021, Myanmar's first elected parliament in half a century convenes. The event underlined a general move towards democracy in the country. 31st January 2020, the United Kingdom officially declared Brexit and withdrew from the European Union. The UK is the only sovereign country to have left the EU. Here is Sue Smallwood with her story, Murder at the Old Folks' Home.
Hello. This piece was written as part of a creative writing course, and the brief was to create an environment and see if you can give it a strong emotional tone. I also had a photograph that was chosen for me, which was the inside of a residential home. Tuesday afternoon, and the entertainer will be here soon. As always, Fred is dressed for the occasion in his best grey suit and highly polished shoes. Mavis, in her hideous blue slippers, is leaning on her walking stick and looking glum as usual. I don't know why, she always enjoys these events. And Bill's chair, subconsciously left empty. His funeral is tomorrow. Agnes, despite her immobility, is eager for the singing to begin as the singer's voice transports her back to her 20s and dancing in the arms of her husband. Ursula's monogrammed slippers seem to dominate the scene. Her angelic face and immaculate clothing match those prim and proper slippers. Her long legs crossed at the ankle. How many years has it been since she waltzed the night away with a bevy of admirers? She smiles briefly as she looks at the tranquil scene before her and the beautiful landscape painting on the wall opposite, and remembers her initial delight at seeing such a familiar picture, the scene of her first murder. Her thoughts turn to tomorrow's funeral, and she smiles as she recollects the fear in Bill's eyes as she murdered him, and she licks her lips in pleasurable anticipation of tomorrow's funeral. Briefly, her glance settles on her next victim before closing her eyes and beginning to plan another murder.
Now, Sue has left her story on a cliffhanger, hasn't she? I wonder if she can be persuaded to write a sequel to this for Roundabout. We'll keep you posted if she does. Here is David Picton with his poem.
Walking on water. Oh no! Oh dear! What's happening here? These things are not as first appear. I'm sure I swam before upon this lake from shore to shore. The breeze is chill, not such a thrill. The lake is calm and very still. I'll venture forth as best I can and leap from rock. Yes, that's my plan. But what's all this? Oh, what the heck? A shock like that could break my neck. The water's hard and hardly wet. The whole damn lake is solid set. The water's flat without a swell. My morning swim's not going well. I'm just a humble duck that swims by thrashing water with my limbs. But now I am what shouldn't be, on top the lake, for all to see. But what is more, when try to stand on my bahookies, where I land, undignified for handsome duck, avert your eyes, please, do not look. Don't laugh out loud about my shame. No doubt you're glad that you all came on this, a frozen day of ice. No doubt you think it very nice. The ice surrounds both left and right. Where'er I look, a frosty sight. You wear your coats of eiderdown while I just slip and slide and clown. While you are dressed as warm as toast, you view my antics full engrossed. It unbecomes a duck like me to walk on water. Don't you agree?
Fortunately, our local black swans haven't had to contend with ice on the Dawlish Brook or surrounding area. Let's find out from Stephen Taylor and Mary MacDonald about the book that they have been reading recently.
Well, this month, Mary and I have been reading a book called The Ascent of Rumdoodle by a British writer, humorist, called W.E. Bowman. And this is my choice because I thought we'd read enough psychological thrillers.
Absolutely.
Christmas was not probably the best time for that. So I wanted to choose a book that was funny. Did you find it funny, Mary?
I read all the blurb first because it had come recommended. So I read everything that was going at the front. And I started reading it and I was quite amused to start with. It's a travelogue. It's so made up, it's unbelievable. And as I progressed, I realised I couldn't do it in a wanna, which sometimes a book like this I can. I just felt it was hard work in a way. And the away being, my inner self was fighting against the language, the implied stupidity. But it was funny in that way.
Yeah, it's a spoof.
It is, it's definitely a spoof. Absolutely.
There were a lot of books written in the 1930s, 1940s by people who were going on these mountaineering expeditions, were climbing huge peaks that had never been climbed before in the Himalayas, and they were writing memoirs. And a lot of them are very self-serving. And he's taken that genre, really, and he has just made huge fun of it. So the book is written by the leader of this non-existent expedition to climb the tallest mountain in the world, which is Ramdoodle, 40,000 and a half.
Yes, that was the first thing that struck me.
And it's every one member of the expedition who's there for a purpose. So there's a doctor and a photographer and a scientist and a linguist and so on. They're all absolutely hopeless. And yes, the comedy comes from their ineptitude, really. And I was laughing very loudly.
I was when I started off. I'm not saying it wasn't humorous. It was, and it was really cleverly written to sustain that, and the characters, and the strange way that the leader believed the good in everyone, even when they were being utterly mean and hateful. But to sustain that for the whole of that book, I thought it was incredible. I mean, that was some mind that did that.
Yeah, I love some of the characters. There's a chef called Pong.
Oh, don't. Right to the end, I was still enjoying Pong.
This is Pong, who's a local. So the local country, it's all invented. The local country is called Yogistan. And they have this peculiar language where they have to belch all the time. And it's just so funny. And Pong is the chef for the expedition. His food is so unspeakably dreadful that they're constantly trying to lose him or shunt him off to some other area. But he's always there. Wherever they go,
back. He's
there. And he ends up climbing the mountain as well with all his pots and pans and his unspeakable food. He's wonderful.
He is. And then, of course, at one point you realise that he's using all the exciting, precious goodies for celebration,
yeah,
all in one go, all piled into one obnoxious concoction.
Ruining it, yeah.
But I did feel that it was a man's book.
Oh, really? Yeah, yes. There aren't very many women in it.
No, it wasn't that so much.
A single woman.
There aren't any. Only the references to fiancés.
Endlessly.
Any references to fiancés. But, and half of them, I believe, were made up. But it's a type of humour, I thought, that was very much geared for men by men.
Maybe. I don't know. It worked for me very well. I thought that there were some very amusing moments. The bit where they go into the crevice and they pretend they're stuck there in order to sort of have a party without the leader.
And take the medical box with all the champagne in. How clever was that?
It is, you know, it's very original. It's a kind of absurdist humour. It's gentle humour, but it is the comedy of the absurd. And I just found it very amusing, particularly the way that the misunderstandings with the local.
Were they misunderstandings? Borders.
Well, there was the bit where 30,000 people turned up for the expedition because the word in Yogastani.
Too many zeros.
For 30,000 is the same as for 30. And it's full of this kind of stuff, and it's very, very amusing.
Stephen and Mary have just reviewed The Ascent of Ramdoodle by W.E. Bowman. This book is available in hardcover, paperback, and as a downloadable audiobook. Aileen Clarkson is taking a break from her letter from a dog walker this month while she is recuperating from an illness. She will be back next month. We now have Valerie Forrester with an article about the lack of knowledge of current affairs amongst many young people.
Life is the name of the game, and I want to play the game with you. Life can be terribly tame if you don't play the game with two. And I want to play the game with you.
Hello, I'm Valerie, and I'm going to read you an article from the January issue of the Saga magazine. It's called Generation Games, and it's by Mark Palmer. Current affairs brought my mother and me particularly close in the 15 years or so after my father died. She always watched the BBC 10 o'clock news before turning in for the night, and I was in the habit of doing the same thing many miles away. This meant that at some point the following day when I called for a chat, we had something in common to discuss. It might have been a reaction to some terrible piece of news, or a comment from her about the tie worn by Hugh Edwards, remember him? Or Fiona Bruce's outfit, which she thought was inappropriate or plain ugly. I still watch the news at 10. It seems to bring the day together and makes me feel more orientated. But my 30-something daughter, Olivia, never watches it. To her, the thought of sitting down for half an hour in front of the TV to hear what's going on around the world must sound like some sort of torture. And she would argue that she's perfectly well informed as it is. But is she? Yes. She knows there's a war going on in Ukraine and that the situation in Gaza is a horrible human tragedy. But beyond that, I fear her reading of the world is shallow. I don't blame her. She's bombarded with snippets of information, photos and video clips, never mind messages from friends via a range of communication platforms. She gets news alerts. But it's the quality of those alerts which worries me, and the absence of analysis. You need analysis in order to reach an opinion. Olivia probably thinks I am over-opinionated, whereas I regard her as under-opinionated. I can talk all day with her husband about the merits of Chelsea deploying four at the back during their next fixture, or whether Joe Root should still be playing limited overs cricket, but the conversation dries up when I raise tricky topics such as, for example, illegal migration or the defence budget. But here's the rub. My son, on the other hand, is remarkably well informed. In fact, he's so well informed that there are times I wish he would keep his opinions to himself. On occasions, I find myself hoping the conversation might dry up when I get him going on some controversial issue or other, so I can't win. My parents' generation was brought up never to discuss religion or politics. Today, I wish some of the young were more, not less, inclined to discuss religion and politics. That's why I like question time on Thursdays. Come have think of it, my mother did too. There is always a smattering of highly charged and highly opinionated young people in the audience, but they tend to be the exception that proves the rule. Towards the end of last year, I had the chance to visit Rwanda. I might be doing Olivia a great injustice, but I'm not sure she knows where that country is, let alone the details of the UK government's controversial plan to send illegal immigrants there. The state of our politics is partly to blame for all this. The young don't believe any party can make a real difference. Even so, I have suggested to Olivia that her New Year resolution should be to watch or listen to the news at least 3 times a week. It won't happen, just as my resolution to cut out drinking spirits during the week won't happen.
Here is Fran Frank with Location, Where in Devon.
Hello again. Some of you may remember a series of articles entitled Where Am I? Well, this month, rather than provide you with a commentary about a recent walk and ask you to guess where I have been, I'm going to supply a number of facts and figures about an area within the county and see if you can work out the location. Don't worry, it won't be too difficult, and I won't keep you on tenterhooks too long. But hopefully you may learn a few additional things about places in and around Devon. Here are the facts to begin with. The town's lighthouse is known as one of the smallest, but also one of the highest in the United Kingdom. A man of colour arrived in the area during 1688, and there is a statue on the harbour side to recognise the event. The hymn, Abide With Me, was written by a local vicar during his short stay in the area, and still rings out across the town from the tower of one of the local churches. One of the largest fishing markets in the UK is based here. And there is a replica of a famous vessel moored in the harbour. Have you guessed yet? All of the facts relate to Brixham. Berryhead Lighthouse has been in operation since May 1906. And although the actual structure in which the light is located is one of the shortest buildings used for this purpose, at only 16 foot high, the beam is recorded as being the highest, as it is located 190 feet above sea level. For your information, the light can be seen from 21 miles away. William of Orange arrived in Brixham on 5th of November 1688 before making his way through Devon towards London. He was apparently carried ashore by a local fisherman, and a statue of him stands on the harbour side looking out over a replica of the Golden Hind. Two answers in one there. Reverend Henry Francis Light, who lived at Berryhead House overlooking Tor Bay, preached at All Saints Church between 1824 and 1847. During his stay, he wrote Abide With Me, which is not only played in various churches around the world, but can also be heard from the tower of All Saints Church at certain times of the day as part of the peal of bells. And finally, the Brixham Fish Market has over the last few years become the largest fish market in the UK. In 2017, they were selling approximately £40 million worth of fish, and by 2022, that figure had risen to over 60 million. Of course, the fishing tradition in Brixham dates back to the 14th century, so I think they probably know a bit about fishing. Well, I hope you managed to guess where the facts related to, and if not, hopefully you have learnt something new and interesting about one of the oldest towns in Devon. Goodbye until next time.
If you were born and bred in Devon or have lived in this region for many years, then you probably had no difficulty guessing the area Fran was talking about. After a bit of geography, let's have a bit of history from John Townsend.
It's probably not politically correct to talk about three blind mice in a programme specifically for the visually impaired, but hopefully you'll forgive me when I explain why the subject has intrigued me this week. Yes, three mice have been running riot in my kitchen, and I now suspect there are more. I don't think they're blind, and no one cut off their tails with a carving knife, but as the nursery rhyme came to mind in the small hours as I tried to catch them under the cooker, I realised how bizarre that traditional children's song really is. Whoever really thought about the words when singing along as a toddler? Well, for those of us who never knew the possible derivation of such a daft song, here's the accepted meaning to that merry jingle about an attack on a trio of visually impaired rodents. The knife-wielding farmer's wife apparently refers to England's Queen Mary I, who got the nickname Bloody Mary because she burned scores of Protestants at the stake, nearly 300 by all accounts. The three blind mice in this story are supposedly the Oxford martyrs, three Anglican bishops who refused to renounce their Protestant beliefs and were executed by Mary for blindly following their Protestant leanings rather than her Catholic ones. Yes, that's the Mary who was the daughter of Henry VIII and his first wife, the Spanish Catherine of Aragon. So when Mary became queen, she did all she could to undo the Protestant Reformation initiated by her father and to restore Roman Catholicism as the state religion. She married the devout Catholic Philip II of Spain, who was busy expanding trade and agriculture, identifying her as the farmer's wife of the Rhine. The three blind mice are supposedly the three bishops, Thomas Cranmer, the Archbishop of Canterbury, Nicholas Ridley, the Archbishop of London, and Hugh Latimer, the Bishop of Worcester, each with a blind devotion to their Protestant faith. After Mary died in 1558, her half-sister Elizabeth took the throne and remained on it for almost 50 years. During the reign of Queen Elizabeth I, England returned once again to being Protestant, but memories of Mary's brutal reign were later immortalised in many a seemingly jolly nursery rhyme. Some think another comes from the same period. Mary, Mary, quite contrary, how does your garden grow? Probably refers to Queen Mary's contrarian decision to reverse her half-brother Edward VI's Protestant reign and restore Roman Catholicism to England. The second line, how does your garden grow, is most often thought to be about Protestant graveyards growing larger after her killing spree. Silver bells and cockle shells are likely both torture devices, and pretty maids all in a row could well be about the female victims she dispatched, such as Lady Jane Grey. What a charming song to sing to children at bedtime. I'd love to explore the origins of other nursery rhymes, but I'm afraid I've got a dash. I've just heard the patter of little feet scampering across the kitchen. Goodbye.
John, you need to get yourself a cat. Norma Orty is here with a selection of her limericks.
There was a young lady from Surrey, whatever she did was done in a hurry. She flew to the moon, got there too soon, and found the moon man in a flurry. There was a woman called Rose, who had a large glowing nose. She must drink a lot, whiskey and gin by the tot. The glow has now spread to her toes. This older man from Dawlish behaved in a manner most foolish. When he tried to feed the fowls, he caused furious howls from the aviary workers in Dawlish. There was an old person at Yule who chiefly subsisted on gruel, but to make it more nice, he inserted some mice, which refreshed that old person from Yule.
If you're looking to start off 2024 on a healthy note, here is a lentil bolognese recipe by Sarah Cook from the BBC Good Food website. It has been given a 4-star rating. Now, the preparation time is given as 15 minutes and it serves 6 people. Cooking time is 1 hour and 15 minutes. The ingredients are as follows: 3 tablespoons olive oil, 2 onions finely chopped, 3 carrots finely chopped, 3 celery sticks finely chopped, 3 garlic cloves crushed, 500 gram bag of dried red lentils, 2 cans of chopped tomatoes, these are the 400 gram cans, 2 tablespoons tomato puree, 2 teaspoons each of dried oregano and thyme, 3 bay leaves, 1 litre vegetable stock, 500 grams of spaghetti, and Parmesan or vegetarian cheese grated to serve. Step 1. Heat the oil in a large saucepan and add the onions, carrots, celery and garlic. Cook gently for 15 to 20 minutes until everything is softened. Stir in the lentils, chopped tomatoes, tomato puree, herbs and stock. Bring to a simmer, then cook for 40 to 50 minutes until the lentils are tender and saucy. Splash in water if you need to, and season well. If eating straight away, keep on a low heat while you cook the spaghetti, following pack instructions for the spaghetti. Drain the spaghetti well, divide between pasta bowls or plates, spoon sauce over the top, and grate over some cheese. Alternatively, cool the sauce and chill it for up to 3 days, or freeze for up to 3 months. Simply defrost the portions overnight at room temperature, then reheat gently to serve. We haven't read out a recipe in this programme before and would be interested to receive your feedback on whether or not you found it easy to follow. Please send your feedback on this or any other aspect of the programme when you are returning the USB stick in the yellow wallet.
Hi, my name's Alice, and I'm from Blind Veterans UK, formerly known as St Dunstan's. We're a national charity that gives blind veterans the free rehabilitation, equipment, training and support they need to live independent lives. Our beneficiaries range from National Service veterans who lost their sight later in life due to age-related conditions, to Iraq and Afghanistan veterans blinded on duty. It doesn't matter when a veteran served or how they lost their sight, we can help. We have a network of community support teams all over the UK who give blind veterans rehabilitation and training at home or in their local area, tailored to their individual wants and needs. We organise activities and events such as lunches, reunions and clubs, which give our veterans the opportunity to be part of a community with a shared experience. We also support veterans to find new hobbies, such as cooking, art and crafts, or a new sport. I'm now going to hand over to one of our blind veterans, Jules, who is going to tell you about his journey with our charity.
Hi everyone, I'm Jules. I was in the Royal Military Police, and when I left the army, I worked for a bank and then for a number of other different companies. During that time, my eyesight slowly deteriorated and my optician referred me to my local eye hospital. There, they registered me as severely visually impaired. From that point, my life really started going downhill. I struggled to find work and I began to feel lonely, depressed, and helpless. The only help that I ever sought out was from my local vision charity. Luckily, there, I found out about Blind Veterans UK. I started the very simple joining process, and because all they required was details of my service record and that of my visual impairment. And very soon, I was a member of Blind Veterans UK. I was amazed because I thought, well, I'm not really blind, and I'm not really a veteran. I thought that veterans had to have served in the Second World War or be in their 90s, but neither of these are true, and you certainly don't have to be totally blind. The charity began to rebuild my life. I met my support worker, and I immediately realized that I was not alone. He visited me at home and assessed different ways in which the charity could help me. And I was provided with lots of equipment. For example, I was given an electronic magnifier, and now I can read all my correspondence and any other documents I need to. Also, I was given an Amazon Echo device, which I use for my talking books, listening to the radio, and getting any other information that I need. All just with the control of my voice. Then I went for an introduction week and my eyes were opened when I realized the possibilities and that I could be doing so much more with my life. I never thought that I would be able to use my computer again, but they taught me how I could do that. And now I can use the internet for all the different purposes that make up everyday life. I then started attending community events and met other blind veterans. For the first time for a long time in my life, I was meeting and making new friends. The charity has an amazing way of bonding veterans together, regardless of their age, their service background, or the level of their sight impairment. Blind Veterans UK has two residential centres where veterans can stay with their partners for activity weeks, training, or simply to have a holiday. The charity has had such an impact on my life, and I would urge anybody who has served in the armed forces and is now struggling with their sight loss to join us. They will give you so much support in whatever way you need it. It comes in so many forms: social support, practical support, emotional support. Whatever you need, the charity is there to help you. I know a lot of veterans don't like asking for help, but when I did, it changed my life for the better, forever.
We know there are thousands of blind veterans out there who need our support. So if you or someone you know served in the armed forces, including national service, and are now struggling with sight loss, then please get in touch by calling us on 0800 389 7979 or by visiting our website at blindveterans.org.uk/get help.
Conclude the program with the song Hello Dolly, sung by Louis Armstrong. It is 60 years since the release of Louis Armstrong's hit version of Hello Dolly and of the Broadway debut of the show.
Hello Dolly, this is Louis, Dolly. It's so nice to have you back where you belong. You looking swell, Dolly. I can tell, Dolly. You still growing strong. I feel the room sway, but the band's playing of our old favorite songs from way back when. So take a rap, fellas, find an empty lap, fellas, darling, never go away again.
Thanks go to Sue Smallwood, David Picton, Stephen Taylor, Mary MacDonald, Valerie Forrester, Fran Frank, John Townsend, and Norma Orty. Thanks also to Diana Coulson and Margaret Reynolds for copying and dispatching the USB sticks, and to Sarah Williams for uploading the programme to our website. The programme was compiled and produced by Camilla Taylor and edited by Stephen Taylor and Mike Smith.